This Fab FM podcast is proudly brought to you by Bendigo Bank, Port Douglas and Mosman, offering a full range of competitive banking products and technology you'd expect from a big bank with the personal service and care you'd expect from us. Drop into your nearest branch at Port Village Shopping Centre or Front Street Mosman. Bendigo Bank, the better big bank.
I mentioned yesterday that I'd be talking to Lonnie Lee today, my good friend, and of course, what an artist he's been for so many decades, a great performer, still doing it, of course, performing and going up to Tamworth, doing shows and all around the place. And of course, COVID-19 brought a halt to that, as it did with all of the artists around Australia. But there's a very special day happening for Lonnie Lee today, and that is his birthday. So here we go. Happy birthday, 80th, to Lonnie Lee. Good morning, Lonnie.
Good morning. My God, you've got so many people in the studio. Listen to them all.
But social distancing. Well, 80 years of age. Did you think you'd ever get to 80?
No, my gosh, no. No, especially not doing, you know, still performing and doing what I love to do, but just the fact of getting to 80, you know, pretty good innings. A lot of people don't get there. A lot of my friends, unfortunately, didn't get there. You know, look at Elvis, look at Johnny O'Keefe, look at so many of those wonderful, talented people dying so young.
Yeah, and I just was reading the other day an article about you, and it said you are the last man standing, and basically you are for the era that you were in.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm the only one that's really doing stuff on the level that I'm doing. Lucky Star does a little bit of stuff out there. Roland Storm's doing a little bit of stuff. But generally speaking, from the level that I was on, from my records and that, yes, I've been the only one doing what I'm doing for a long, long time. Cole retired about, maybe 12, 15 years ago. Now, could be around 12 years ago.
Cole Joy?
That was Cole Joy. Johnny O'Keefe, of course, we lost a long time ago, and they were my only rivals from records and television.
Well, they weren't really your rivals because you loved all of your fellow artists, and I know you particularly had a soft spot for J.O.K.
Yes, they were all my friends. I say rivals, and the misuse of the word, of course, but we really weren't. There was a little bit of sort of friendly competition there, mainly between Cole Joy and Johnny O'Keefe.
Yes.
Jock didn't see it too much that way, although he was pretty edgy. He didn't like anyone to get on top of him. But as far as I was concerned, I never saw anyone as a competitor. I just went and did my stuff, you know.
Well, absolutely wonderful. I was telling the listeners yesterday morning that you certainly don't look 80. You've kept yourself very much in trim. You don't smoke, you don't drink. The only thing I said, you run around with one wild woman, Suzanne. And as I said yesterday, I only said that because I'm a long way from her.
Oh, dearie me.
Yeah,
she's a wild girl.
I'll tell you, folks, she's, basically Lonnie's manager. She takes care of the dough, so to speak, the box office, and boy, oh boy, nothing gets past Suzanne.
She's a darling. Married now for 36 years, I think.
36, wow. I'm just saying that, you know, she calls a spade a front-end loader.
She certainly does. Oh, yeah, she's not afraid to not afraid to do that.
I mentioned yesterday to the listeners that, you know, your music was the soundtrack to my life as I was growing up. And I never, ever realised in my wildest dreams that we would become friends. And, you know, to grow up with somebody you admire so much and then be able to break bread with them and have a chat and a real chat as friends, it's been an absolute treat for me and an honour for Marion and I to know you two.
Oh, thank you so much. The honour's all mine because you're lovely people and it's always good to know lovely people. No, we've had some wonderful times, haven't we? Especially at your wedding recently down there. That was a wonderful day.
It was terrific. And I'm just thinking back in November when Mary and I got married and you were there with all of our other friends from interstate and also from Adelaide as well. I just think we wouldn't be able to do that now. So lucky we just got in under the wire.
I know. I mean, it's ridiculous what's going on today. Absolutely absurd.
Well, here it is, your 80th birthday. Let's go back to the early days. Now, although you became a pop star, a rock star, if you like, in the 60s, it all started with rockabilly and a rockabilly band. Now, how did that all come about and how was that formed back then?
The roots of everything of my singing were actually was in a church choir. And during while I was a kid, like, you know, 10, 12, 14 years of age, and while I was doing that, I was starting to listen to radio. I built my own little crystal set radio that I used to listen to at night. Now, the things that I used to hear then, it was all the crooners, and Johnny Ray was the one that messed up my brain. I just loved his songs, and I loved the way that he would sing his songs. And so that was the start of me wanting to actually sing things other than hymns and church stuff. And that, as time went on, and the everything changed, and the crooners changed, and rock and roll came in, you know, Blackboard Jungle and Rock Around the Clock and all that, and that whole incredible explosion that got all of us young kids. Elvis entered into my life with his early rockabilly stuff. Now, in May 1956, I went into an amateur hour on Radio 2UW. And on that amateur hour, I wanted to sing a Johnny Ray song, Cry. And they said, oh, no, you can't do that because somebody's already done it a few weeks ago. And it turned out that somebody was Johnny O'Keefe, because he also was a Johnny Ray lover.
Yeah.
Anyway, I ended up singing Heartbreak Hotel. Now, Heartbreak Hotel was absolutely brand new. It was brand new in America. They introduced me by saying, and here's Laurie Ricks singing a song by a guy with a funny name. Anyway, I came second for that one. And then 6 months later, MGM, who were promoting Elvis's first movie, Love Me Tender, they were having big problems because everyone was saying, it's going to die here, it's going to flop, because no one knows who this guy is. And so they thought, we better start promoting things. Now, they did quite a lot of promotion around the place, and it was much harder to do then than it is now. But part of what they decided to do was to hire the Trocadero in Sydney and to run a big contest to find Australia's, if there was an Australian Elvis Presley. So anyway, I ended up going in it, and I ended up winning it. Now, because of that, I'd already started working a few jobs as a singer in 1956 because of the amateur hour. But winning this Elvis thing, it really bumped everything up. And part of the offers I was getting, I had to have a band. So what I did, I started my little rockabilly band. Now, it was a guy called Billy Mostyn, and Billy Mostyn was a country guitar player, and I wanted a bass player. But in those days, the upright bass player were only played by the orchestras and jazz. So the only thing we could do was we got a T-chest and a broom handle. We attached the broom handle to the T-chest and then ran some thick string down from the top to the bottom inside the T-chest. And so when you bent the broom handle, the string tightened, and you got that sound, just like an upright bass. Anyway, that was my little rockabilly band. And we started working. I was working every night of the week. Now, mind you, I'm just 16, right? I'm working every night of the week and a Saturday afternoon at a little hotel in Tempe. During the day, I'm still working in the bank. And ultimately, this came to the end where the bank manager said, well, son, you know, we're tired of you coming into the bank with your light blue jackets on instead of a suit and your pink shirt and white tie. And now is the chance for you to make a big decision. You either, if you want to be sing and do all that stuff, whatever you want to do, well, you're going to have to go one way. Or if you want to be in the bank, you're just going to have to change. And I said, well, I'm sorry, I my heart is in doing the other stuff. So that's why I left the bank and how I got into full-time, full-time music. We had lots and lots of fun. It was a wonderful time for us.
Now, of course, you became a pop star and you had Starlight, Star Bright, and you had all of those wonderful hits that you had in the 60s. But you never kind of strayed away full-time from country music or rockabilly. When so many people are kind of a little embarrassed in Australia, not so much in the United States, they embrace it. But here in Australia, there's a lot of people who go, oh, country and Western music, I don't like it. But you've never been afraid to play that part as well.
No, not at all. You know, when I started to learn guitar, the only people who were playing guitar those in times, other than people in orchestras, and I didn't know anything about those, were country people in the country. Mostly it was the American stuff that I was attracted to, as opposed to the Australian bush ballads. But so when I was learning guitar, and I taught myself, it was the Hank Williams and all those wonderful, the Carter family and all those wonderful early country, American country singers that that got me into playing the guitar. And then when rockabilly came along, of course, that just, and Elvis, that blended right into it. Many times when I recorded, even when I was a big star, there were many times that I recorded country songs. And mind you, they didn't get play. You know, even in the country stations back in those days, you know, out in the back blocks, they didn't, because I was a pop star, they sort of shunned me. Now, when my contract was up with Festival Records in about 65, I was offered this really sweet deal to go to HMV. And now HMV didn't have really any pop stuff going at all. It was all country. They had Slim and they had all the other country acts. And so they thought that they could turn me, a pop act, into and take advantage of all the country stations. And so they, if I recorded something that was more country, they would release it and they would promote me out into these country areas and become like Australia's first crossover. Anyway, I did this album, which happened to be the first stereo album in Australia. I did this album called Country Boy at Heart, but unfortunately they didn't promote it. So, of course, it was a dud, and their idea of me crossing into the country and being accepted by the country just never really happened. And even till today, even though I recorded lots of country-style songs like that rockabilly band and many others, the traditional country people of Tamworth and all that shun me and will not play. They don't play my records.
But it is country and it is wonderful. And, of course, you go up to Tamworth to entertain there as well. Look, I just love it. I've always loved my country music and I just love it when I hear you sing it. Lonnie, there's a song, I love songs about trains, and you've got that song Northwest Mail. That's a true story, isn't it? It's about, I take it you were in Sydney, but you were summoned back to the land.
Yes, well, what happened there, that was the story. You know, when I was talking about the rockabilly band, and I was working every night at the hotel and working in the daytime in the bank. Now, toward the end of the nine-month contract that I had at that little hotel, it was coming up to Christmas. It was early December, and I was tired because I was still young. You know, I just turned 17, and I was still young, and I was working every day in the bank and every night doing the pub. And so Saturday morning, I was driving to the bank because we worked Saturday morning in those days, and somehow I came up to the top of this hill. And as I reached the crest and came over the top, something went wrong with the steering and just felt something happened. I wasn't too sure what it was. I put my foot on the brake to slow down, and I didn't slow down. So something was happening under there. Anyway, I'm screaming down this hill thinking, what am I going to do? Pumping the brake and nothing's happening. And I'm veering over onto the other side of the road. Fortunately, no cars were coming up. Otherwise, I would have had a head on. Anyway, I'm screaming down the road, and I know that I'm heading for a telegraph pole on the other side of the road. And so I, quite amazingly, without even thinking, I jumped into the back seat of the car where I had my guitar. And a few seconds later, we hit the pole. The telegraph pole broke, fell over the top of the car, and pushed the motor back into the back of the front seat. Would have been absolutely no hope at all for me. So I'm in the back seat. So what happened? My father heard about this because he was in the country in the sheep property, and he was never really in for me going into this rock and roll stuff. It wasn't so much the devil's music, but he thought, you know, you've got to get a proper career, and we want you back here in the land, and you become a station manager and all that sort of stuff. Anyway, he heard about it, and he said, well, I told you rock and roll was no good for you. We're going to go send you back to the country. So him and my mother got together and said, that's it, you're out of Sydney. So I went back to the sheep property for a year. So for the whole of 1958, I'm back with sheep, crutching sheep and shearing sheep and all the rest of the stuff.
And you went back via the Northwest Mail and you wrote a song about it.
I did, because that was the one during boarding school, we used to catch that train. because I was in boarding school for like 8 years, and we used to catch that train every time there was a holiday, and we loved the train. It was overnight, you know, it took 24 hours or something to get to our little place in Rowena, and so we just loved that train. But this time I didn't like it at all, because I didn't want to leave the city. I didn't want to leave my music, and so that's why I wrote about the about that particular time.
Now, Lonnie, let me go to a song called "It Takes Me Back." Now, when I listen to this song, it's not really PC, is it?
No, it isn't. Well, especially in one verse.
Yes.
Right down the back end.
And what was the verse you're referring to?
Well, it was a few little things. One, that everyone spoke English and cabbies knew the way, and you could always trust your tradesman.
To really earn his pay.
To really earn his pay. That was right. Yeah, but the tradesman thing, that was okay, although that's a bit funky today. But
yeah.
The thing that got a lot of people questioned, in fact, one particular station, they refused to play it. They said, no, you can't say that, when I said everyone spoke English.
Well, that's exactly right. I mean, you know, I mean, we should be able to, like you say, have freedom of speech. And, yeah, not everybody speaks English. I think that everyone should be able to speak English before they become a citizen. I think that's just fair.
Absolutely. Certainly not as good as you and I. But they're out there trying their best to speak English. And I put myself in a position, if I went to one of these countries and planted myself there, I would have an incredibly hard job trying to speak their language. So I have great respect for anyone who tries, but I do believe that there has to be some basic modicum of English so that we can understand what they're talking about, what they want. And I put that in there because I've got to say something. I mean, if we've got freedom of speech, which of course is very challenging now, of whether or not we do actually have the freedom of speech that we used to have before. But although these things, there weren't any angst to me at all. No,
absolutely. We're talking with Lonnie Lee, celebrating his 80th birthday. Though we've been having a chat to Lonnie, and talking about a few songs that he's recorded and songs that we can play on our country radio station here, Fab FM. Now, we get to a song, Lonnie, called New Limousine. Now, I know you talked about that car that you hit the pole with and you were in the back seat. Thank God you're in the back seat. What's the best car you've ever owned?
I think the best car that I've ever owned was a 90. But mind you, when I owned them at the time, they were always the best car, you know, because that's all I could afford or whatever. But I look back now and my heart is still with a 1959 Belvedere. It was just a wonderful car. I just loved it. It was a two-door, and in those days, the windows went down, so the whole area was free. There wasn't any bar between the windows. That was my favorite. That was my favorite car. And I bought that in late 1960, and I had it for a couple of years. And the thing is, it was really strange because it was very, very modern. Here, there's hardly any American car here. Because like a top of the range. And during that time, I was doing a lot of country tours. So I was going out on tours. And while we were on the tar roads, the bitumen roads, everything was fine because this had power steering. And power steering was very, very new. No one hardly knew about it here. And so it was fine. And it was sort of low on the road. Anyway, as soon as we got onto the dirt roads, then there'd be problems. And I remember I was out, it had rained out here on the dirt roads out in the at the back of New South Wales in a place called Brewarrina, and we were touring out there. And so some of the, because the mud and stupid people had gone along in their cars in the mud and created all these grooves, and then when they dried like concrete. So you come along and you're hitting all these grooves under the bottom of the car, and it ripped my power steering out.
Oh.
Just ripped it out. So here I am with this car. This is it's as big as a tank, and I had to get to a garage and got took the power steering off, and I had to use just regular steering, which was extremely difficult. Because
yes,
it's really, really heavy.
Yeah, driving a tank. Hey, listen, what color was it?
Blue. A gunmetal. more than blue.
Gunmetal. I'm just having a look at it here. Made by Chrysler. It was called Plymouth Belvedere. It was made by Chrysler from 1954 to 1970, marketed under the Plymouth brand.
It was just beautiful. Well, I loved it, man. And of course, in those days, the gear changed because it was automatic, but it was buttons. You pressed buttons on the dashboard, and that changed the gears. And the steering wheel wasn't totally round. On the top, it was like a little flat on the top up there. It was a beautiful car. I just absolutely adored it. And I've tried to find it since, but somehow it's disappeared. A friend of mine in Hobart, maybe 15 years ago, said they're pretty sure that they saw it down there, but no one's seen it since. But I have heard that there's some guy in Hobart who's gone around Launceston that's got several sheds, and he's got 50 or 60 of these American cars that he has in these sheds, and no one can get to him, won't let anyone go and see him, so it's maybe there.
We're talking with Lonnie Lee, celebrating his 80th birthday. Hey, Lonnie, I found a 1967 Plymouth Belvedere two-door, blue, light blue in colour for sale.
Okay, what year?
Ooh, that got him excited. 1967.
Oh, that's a 60, yes. I don't know about the 67.
Oh, pardon me. Sorry.
I don't think I'd get my rocks off for a 67. I
mean, how much do you think they want for it?
Well, if it's really in really good order, maybe 35,000, 40,000.
Oh, you're on the mark. 29,800.
Yeah, that'll be right. My very first car was a 1928 Essex.
Ooh.
It was a square thing. I was about 16, and it was a square sort of thing. It was bright orange. Of all the colours, and but you had to crank it because it didn't have a starter. So every time I had to do it, I had to crank it. I had it for about 6 months, and then I moved from that to a 38 Dodge, and that's the car that I had my accident in. That was also a very, very heavy car too.
Hey, that 67 Plymouth Belvedere for sale for 29,800. How many Ks do you reckon it's done?
Ks or miles?
Ks.
Ks. If it's done a lot, it could be up to 200,000 Ks. But if it's pretty new, it's about, I don't know, maybe 20, 30?
5,000 Ks.
5,000? You're kidding.
No, I'm not kidding. 5,000 Ks genuine, it says.
Wow. Well, whoever's got that car is like some of these people. They buy these things when they're new, years and years, and then they keep them. And when they get another car, They don't resell it or trade it in or whatever. They just put it away and put it in mothballs and just leave it in the paddock.
What about the song "New Limousine" we're about to play? How did that come about?
Well, that was, I guess, just not so much out of my imagination, because it was one of these things. You know, I do Winter Sun every year, or I used to do it pretty much every year, and they call it Cooley Rocks now, and so. There were like up to 1,000 of these beautiful cars, anything from the old T-model Fords right through, mainly the 60s, 50s and 60s cars, and they're just absolutely glorious. And so when I go there, my heart thumps when I walk along and see these beautiful things. And so I know the pride that people who own these cars, I know what they feel with them. These cars are, in a way, sometimes more important than their wives, their mothers, their children,
right.
the car is the be-all and end-all of everything. And so I wrote this song with that sort of stuff in mind, thinking about my beautiful cars that I've been lucky enough to have over the years also. And so it was about this guy who bought this car. He got this brand new limousine, and it can purr like a kitten. It can do absolutely everything that you want. So in a way, the way I've done the words, it could be, I could be talking about a woman, but I'm not. I'm in fact talking about a car.
Just before we go, I thank you very much for joining us this morning. I just wanted to tell people, and I have told them before, that although you're 80 years of age, you've kept yourself in good nick. You're a vegetarian. When did were you always a vegetarian?
No, I wasn't. In fact, I was a big meat eater, being in the country. It was me as a young jackaroo when I was like in my early teens. I was given the job. I had to go out and because we ate our own meat, you know, I had to go out and and pick the sheep, and I it was me that had to kill the sheep and dress the meat and do all that, and some of my early breakfasts were made up of about four chops, 14 eggs, and you know I was a really really big meat eater and carnivore and all that stuff. It wasn't until I guess when I was in about 25. I went through a self-realization period. My big career had certainly hadn't come to an end, but it tapered off a bit because the English invasion had come, the Beatles and all that had changed, had come through. My young teenagers who were 10 and 12 and 15 and 16 now were getting married and moving on and moving into other types of music and whatever. And so everything was changing. So I was starting to think, I've always been an introspective sort of a person, and I was starting to think, who is this guy, this singer, this that everyone raves about and that is so popular, and who is me? Who is me inside, the person inside that has all these thoughts and desires and fears and all that sort of stuff? So I went into this whole thing. It took me on a journey through Zen Buddhism and into lots and lots of areas and psychology and whatever. And part of it was landing on in a spot where I just found out that I didn't want to kill anymore, anything. Doesn't matter what it was. And so part of that was having to become a vegetarian, which I did. And then because I was a vegetarian in those days, a veggie was someone who ate ate carrots and lettuce, and that was about it.
Right.
And so I had to. So it was very difficult finding anywhere where you could get anything. So I really had to look into the health part of it because I didn't want to be unhealthy as I got older. So I really learned and studied the whole business of nutrition and whatever. And so as I went through that story, then I became convinced that I was definitely on the right path. And so I have been on that now for 50-odd years.
And you look wonderful. You certainly don't look 80. I would say 50, 60 or something like that.
Picking hard. Give me a kiss.
No, you're absolutely wonderful. That's true. And but how did you avoid the grog and the drugs living in that world back in the 60s?
Well, you know, it in a way it was difficult. Sometimes it was difficult because, you know, everyone was out partying and whatever, and I'd go along there, of course, but they were all getting sloshed and all that, and most of the time I'd be there, I'd be just go into the kitchen and start talking to the women and or whatever, to the father.
That's it. You know what? That's exactly, Lonnie, what I used to do at parties. I'd go talk with the ladies. The blokes would be down the other end. And they would have the audacity to look at me and say, "Hey, Macon, you're gay, are you?" I never could work that one out.
I know. Well, I got the same story 100 times, believe me. But mind you, there was a time there when I had some upsets in my life, in the very, very, very early part of my life, like when I was a young adult. My marriage fell apart only after a year and a half, and I was left with two young children. And those days, it was very difficult because no one wanted to know. There wasn't help like there is today. I couldn't get any help, and I was on tour and all that. So that was a really difficult time for me, and a great time of introspection. And that was part of the thing that sent me into self-realization. But it was during that time that I was friends with, very close friends with John Lewis and Brian Henderson at the time, and they, both of them, had just gone out of marriages as well. So that there was the three of us were sort of wandering around. So we were all hitting the turps a little bit then, and I did also myself, and but not much at all. I wasn't out there doing it like everybody else, and I never hit the drugs. I was never interested in drugs at all.
Lonnie Lee, it's been an absolute pleasure today. A very happy 80th birthday. Anything planned for today with the wonderful Suzanne?
No, not really, except they all wanted to have a big party and all that, which I did when I was 70 and 75, and they wanted to have a big special thing. I'm really not for that because I get a bit embarrassed about all the fuss over me, but because of the times of COVID and all this business that you can only have 1.5 people around you, they found it was just too difficult. So what we decided to do is just tonight we're just going to go and have a very close family dinner, you know, and then I'll catch up with everybody who would like me to over the next few weeks, you know, bit by bit.
Lonnie, you must be absolutely busting to get back on tour.
Oh, I am. Believe me, absolutely. And it looks like there's no hope. We've had jobs cancelled and tours cancelled absolutely everywhere. I have a season at Christmas in a beautiful little restaurant called the Waterview. You've been there.
Yep.
And so I usually do that on Christmas time and for like 5-6 weeks.
That restaurant is on the Hawkesbury, the waterfront. It's an absolutely beautiful venue, and Marion and I caught you there for that show. It was absolutely wonderful.
And anyway, I'm thinking, oh, no, that's gone. There's no way in the world that'll happen. But the guy who owns the restaurant, he called and he said, well, you know, he said, I've retired, but the people who are running it now, they're still interested. And they say that all the Probus clubs and the Lions clubs and Rotary, who are the people who take their members there, they still want to do it. And if we, by law, if we can do it, it's still on. Do you still want to do it? And of course, I said, oh, yes, I definitely want to do it. And that's a daily thing. We do that every day of the week. And we get about 150 people in there having a beautiful lunch. And so I'm hoping that's going to be on. I don't know. Other than that, Tamworth has hit the road. So that's the end of Tamworth, although we may still go up there for 3 or 4 days and do some shows ourselves anyway. And, of course, a lot of people are calling us and writing to us and on Facebook and all that sort of stuff, asking us where we're going to be performing. But then I end up having to give them another question mark because we don't know. We're making plans for next year, but whether or not that's going to happen, because some of the states now are saying that maybe not until the middle of next year will they open, which is ludicrous.
Well, Lonnie, if you're singing at that beautiful, beautiful restaurant there on the Hawkesbury River, please stay safe. Make sure you're okay, because I think you're a living legend. You are a national treasure.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much. Wonderful. Lovely talking to you, and thank you for your interest. You're a dear friend.
All right.
And your better half, Marion.
Oh, yes, you better get that in. All right, mate, have a wonderful day with Suzanne and the family, and God bless.
Beautiful. Thank you. Take care.